I guess my concern is, I think that Macquarie's gone too far down the options path. There's no other listed company in the top 50 that has 13% of its total capital in options. I mean, that's market value of $1.8 billion, and it's going up. You issued, based on market value, you issued $650 million worth of options last year, already showing a paper profit of $350 million. Exercised last year across the bank was 6.4 million options, where they paid roughly $160 million, and the profit on that's roughly $250 million. So just in the last 12 months alone, in terms of new options issued and older options exercised, there's a paper gain of $600 million. And that's on top of all the stratospheric salary figures that we see in some of the reports. So I just think that it is going a bridge too far. And how much more incentive does Alan Moss need? I mean, if you've got a $60 million equity play and you're getting $18 million a year, you don't need this. He doesn't need any more incentive. And I think the Neds have let us down here. I just think it's got out of hand. I mean, look at the top four. I'm only going to speak on this resolution. The four directors concerned here got $31 million in salary last year, already own $143 million worth of shares. I mean, how much more incentive do you need when you've got that much on the table? You've got options with a face value of $49 million. Your paper profit between the four of you is about $100 million. I just can't for the life of me see why you need to be going back to the trough once again when you already have a massive incentive. And I think, given that you've denied the shareholders a chance to vote on your remuneration policy, which I think was regrettable given what Rinker and CSR did, that these resolutions are the opportunity for the shareholders to send a message to the board that we want a little bit of moderation. There is a sense in the community that Macquarie's gone too far, and these resolutions, particularly Mr. Moss, who's having an increase from last year. Last year he got 165,000, this year he's getting 180,000, the other three are going down, and they're pretty minor. So I just think that shareholders should send a message based on the figures that I've laid out here that it's time for a little bit of moderation in the way this bank runs its options scheme.
I made earlier about why it's important just to be internationally competitive, but that's essentially what drives the whole remuneration system of Macquarie Bank. Either we compete with our global peers on the full range of remuneration battles, or we don't. And then, the consequences if we don't are very clear. We won't have a bank. And I think it's irrelevant whether Mr. Moss leaves, or I leave, or anyone else leaves. More or less, that's not the issue. The issue is that if we don't compete, our staff will go to places who didn't pay market salaries, and I'm falling on the trap myself. I should also correct you on the use of the word salary, because a very small percentage of Mr. Moss's and mine and everyone else's remuneration of the bank is salary. So the basic salary is about 4% of the total. The rest is totally dependent on performance, and if the performance is not there, none of that gets paid. Options are similarly awarded annually and on the same, on similar but not identical performance criteria. So I won't give you the speech all over again, but it's not a question of making a judgment about whether this is socially good or bad. It's about being competitive in the international investment banking business, and we can either be competitive and continue to produce returns to shareholders, which is what I imagine shareholders want, or we can try and impose something artificial, in which case everyone will
leave. Thanks, Chairman. A question on governance. I'm a shareholder in all of the vehicles, and I know there's been a big debate about potential conflict of interest between your funds and the bank and the way the fees flow, and part of your defence is that we just make an enormous amount of disclosure to the market on the financials of the fund. One thing I haven't actually been able to spot, and I may have missed it in the disclosures, is when a fund makes a big deal and the bank is the advisor, you never actually come out and say what the fee was. Now, for mine, that's actually a very material and important figure. And I'm a shareholder in Macquarie Communications Group. In the last 4 months, you've just splurged $10 billion on three deals, two in the UK, National Grid and Airwave, and Global Towers in the US. You've raised capital. I put $5,000 into the SPP. I've lost $300 or $400, I think, on that. You've put up here how these deals have all been great for the bank, but you've never actually disclosed how much in success fees or advisory fees or debt management fees you have extracted from me as a shareholder in MCG for that deal. And for mine, that is a clear-cut, related party transaction. You've got a foot in both camps. We need to see the figure. How do we know the figure is not exorbitant? We've just got to trust the independent directors. So why don't you disclose related party transactions on these deals specifically, deal by deal, so that the market, the investors can be assured that they're not being gouged. And, you know, the obvious sort of incentive would be if there's a $100 million success fee flowing from Thames Water to the bank, let's do the deal because the bank gets $100 mil. And, you know, we can only guess what the fee is because we see Thames Water on the cover of the annual report. And I think that these figures should be disclosed. So I'd like some commentary as to why those figures aren't disclosed. And I'd like to bring in the auditor into that, Ian Hammond, and just to have another aspect to this question, and that is that down at Babcock and Brown, they have a position where the auditor of the bank, Babcock and Brown, is Ernst & Young, and therefore there's a conflict of interest in having Ernst & Young being the auditor of any of the other associated funds. Now, I'm an investor in all of the other associated funds at Babcock as well, so I've seen this situation. Now, there's a bit of a problem down there at Babcock's because PricewaterhouseCoopers actually provides an office to the chairman of their audit committee, and for mine, they avoid one conflict and create another massive conflict because all the other funds happen to choose PwC, which happens to provide an office to the chairman of the Babcock audit committee. Now, the situation at Macquarie is different. PwC gets the lot. So my question, perhaps Catherine Livingston as chairman of the audit committee should come in on this one as well, is why do you have that position where it's okay for PwC to audit everything when it is different from the Babcock situation? And it comes back to the disclosure, that why aren't we being told the transaction-specific fees, which are going to be running for tens of millions of dollars when the funds flow back and forth. So if you guys want to be, you know, on the high, you know, high-level governance, you want to be able to say that we're holier than now, I think these are the sorts of issues you need to deal with. They're only minor in the broader scheme of things about governance at Macquarie, but the auditor question, independent auditors of the funds, and better disclosure of the success fees, for mine, are probably two of the biggest crosses where you can make some serious advances if you make some serious things.
Well, I think, Australian, you answered part of the question yourself, but whenever there is a related party transaction, the standard practice is that Macquarie-related directors do not vote and that the entire decision is made by the independent directors. My understanding is that fees, whilst perhaps not always disclosed on a transaction by transaction basis, are disclosed in the aggregate by the individual funds all the time. And on the audit question, I prefer to wait until we come to deal with the audit at the end of this section when questions to the auditor can be advanced, hopefully.
Just a one-liner first, Chairman. The profit share works at about 57%. At some level. So if the shareholders have made $40 billion, does that mean the staff have made $50
billion? No, because the staff don't participate in the value creation through share appreciation or anywhere near the same extent.
Okay. Now, look, this is the resolution of the meeting. This is the main event today, everyone, because what's happened is Institutional Shareholder Services, which is the most powerful proxy advisory firm in the world, which has humbled companies from Rio Tinto to Zinifex and Oxiana with recommendations to their institutional clients to vote down resolutions, most notably remuneration reports, have this year decided to take on the great Macquarie machine. And what has happened is they've put out their report saying vote down the remuneration report, and Macquarie have launched probably the most vigorous campaign against such a report that's been seen in the Australian market. So there's been a hell of a debate behind the scenes with Macquarie making representations to their major shareholders, to ISS, to others, saying in defence of the Macquarie model. And you have to say the Macquarie model has been spectacularly successful. And I, for one, will be voting my one share in favour of the remuneration report. on the basis that you shouldn't change a winning formula. However, there are a couple of rules of engagement which I think we need to establish at first, Chairman. Some of my questions are going to relate to the proxies, and I need to see the proxies to be able to ask the questions. So last year you withheld the proxies until the end of the debate, so we didn't see them until after lunch. And I'd ask you initially this year if you could change that policy, because the big event that will come out of today is how many shares were, after this amazing campaign, voted against the remuneration report. You know the figure, we don't. So could you enlighten us just on that one figure? How many shares, how many proxies were voted against the remuneration report this year?
Well, as I said last year, when we look around the world and look at best practice in this area, without any doubt, corporate governance recommendations are that you should not disclose proxies which would potentially affect the vote. So we are going to disclose them. As last year, we're going to disclose the proxies before the end of the meeting, but we're not going to disclose them before people
Could I ask you to test the mood of the meeting on that? I think that it's absolutely immaterial for this discussion that we know this figure now. And the reason I say that is that I know that Macquarie has been making representations to institutions saying, if you're going to vote against us, please just abstain. Please don't actually take on the model, just abstain. And the other important point that I want to tease out today is the commercial relationships that Macquarie has with its major shareholders. And for me, that's the governance issue which is at the heart of this debate, is that Macquarie is the most powerful brand in the Australian financial system. Everyone needs to be on the train with Macquarie for floats and capital raisings and all this sort of stuff. So when Macquarie devotes their resources to persuading their institutional shareholders to vote a certain way, they have a lot of power behind that. And I mean, the example I'd give you is, for instance, AXA, which owns 13 million shares, is the second biggest shareholder in Macquarie. Now, when the French tried to mop up AXA, it was Macquarie that did the defence. So Macquarie has a commercial relationship as AXA's advisor, and they got paid very well to defend against the French. Fast forward 3 years, and AXA's being asked by Macquarie, please don't vote against our remuneration report, because this is the model that's made the machine, and if you really have to vote against it, please abstain. So, and then you can run similar arguments with the other major shareholders. So that's why, Chairman, I think for the purposes of an informed debate, it is reasonable that we be told the proxies at the outset. It's a non-binding resolution anyway. The actual figures don't matter a fig for the law, but the figures do matter for the purposes of this debate. Hence, my request that you test the meeting as to whether maybe it's after 15 minutes, maybe it's not right now, but before we finish discussing the remuneration report, I'd like to see the proxies so we can have some further discussion about what it all means. Because if there is a big protest vote, it is a big challenge to the Macquarie model, which could have implications. So I think it's not an unreasonable request, and I'd ask you to test that with the meeting.
Mr. Mann, as I think you know, motions can't be put on during the meeting from the floor. If you genuinely want to test this, I would suggest you formally move a motion for next year. We've seriously considered the issue, and we believe that whilst there are arguments on both cases, best practice internationally and in Australia is that you don't bias the vote by disclosing the proxies, but you do disclose the proxies before the meeting. So, at the end of the meeting, you'll know what the proxies are, but it'll be after you vote, not before you vote. Now,
I appreciate your right as chair to make determinations. The one request I'd have is the right to speak after the proxies are disclosed. Is that something you can afford me?
Let me take that on notice. I'd like to think about it.
I mean, no. I'm going to labour the point, but you talk about proxies, well, you know, the good governance argument is that we'll be intimidated. If we get the proxies, you know, it'll squash the debate. Now, I can give you countless examples of the way boards opportunistically run the arguments. When Rupert Murdoch had 98% in favour of his move to America, he flashed up the proxies within 2 minutes of the meeting starting. He just said, there you go, you can all get stuffed, I've flogged you all. So that's the world's most powerful man. Okay, so you haven't done that, and the longer you hold out, the more I think you've actually suffered quite a protest, and you're sitting on it. I mean, that's the only conclusion that I can draw. And in talking about not wanting to intimidate, this is where the question of how big the protest is gets important, because you say you don't want us to be intimidated. Now, my concern is the way that you've conducted a little bit of a campaign with your major shareholders. And I'll cite you the example of, for instance, Barclays. Barclays own 13 million Macquarie Bank shares. They're our second biggest shareholder. Now, when Macquarie Communications Group had a share placement 6 or 8 weeks ago, they now raised $700 million. You Macquarie bankers allocated to Barclays $60 million worth of shares. So they lifted their stake in MCG from 7% to 9%. Like everyone else in this market, they rely on the good grace of Macquarie that when you're doing your capital raising, that you'll put them at the front of the queue, you'll give them a big allocation. Now, if Barclays come out today and vote their 13 million shares against you and leave you with some egg on your face and some bad publicity, the temptation next time there's a capital raising at MCG or anywhere else is, well, sod Barclays, they voted against our REM report. And that's the behaviour, I'm not going to use the intimidation word, but that's the behaviour that worries me, because from what I understand, you have run a very vigorous campaign. Now, normally, when ISS says vote against the remuneration report, it runs at 30 to 40%. And if you come out today with 90%, and last year you got 95% in favour when ISS said vote in favour. So if you come out with 85%, and others are going to say, what did you say to your major shareholders? Because there is, you know, a potential conflict. You don't have to say anything on the phone. It would just be, we don't want to upset Macquarie. They play hard. They might punish us. So can you tell us, Chairman, about the way you've conducted yourselves as a bank with your major shareholders in attempting to persuade them to vote in favour of the remuneration report? What has been the level of the campaign that you have run to try and get the approval vote up as high as possible?
Mr. Mayne, can I make 3 points in relation to that? First of all, investor relations is a normal function that is carried in day in, day out, and that was part of what was going on. Secondly, ISS refused to give us a copy of their report and refused to circulate our report to shareholders, so we had no alternative but to contact shareholders directly. And thirdly, I can give you a complete assurance that there is no link to business, and there's both, we didn't seek to make a link, and there was no link. So there's no, we don't necessarily like it if they vote against the REM report, but we certainly don't. That does not bias our behaviour. And in fact, the people who are making those decisions because of the way that Macquarie tends to decentralise decision making are different people to the ones who are talking to them. If they choose to take something like that into account, that's their business. It's not something we, in any way, sought to influence.
Well, the Grown Index. This is my last contribution. The number one criticism from ISS about the Macquarie pay model is that there's an overemphasis on short-term cash bonuses. They say that it's, depending on how you argue it, it's 60, 70, on some measures up to 90% of pay in a year is the short-term cash bonus. And I guess some people are looking for you to give a bit of ground on this, to sort of say, well, okay, we won't just do 10% of the short-term bonus in shares, we'll do 20% in shares. And the other comment that's made is, what happens on the downside? So if something really bad happens at Macquarie, and we actually produce a loss, or something goes really, really wrong, Alan Moss has been paid $100 million of cash in the last decade. Cash. So he doesn't need to work. And he's only got, and I shouldn't say only, he's got $35 million worth of Macquarie Bank fully paid ordinary shares. So that, I think, demonstrates the point that there's been so much cash paid that if something bad does happen, many of you are at the level of not needing to worry. Whereas if you had a greater proportion of your pay tied up in options and tied up in shares that are based on vesting on length of service and things like that, it would provide better incentives. So that is the fundamental criticism that ISS is making, and I think that's the one that you need to actually specifically address today is why it is necessary for Elon Musk to get $23 million short-term bonus, 90% of which is cash. Now, I know that you do lock up 20% of the short-term bonus, but you don't put it into shares. You lock it up in cash in Macquarie funds, and it sits there, and as long as he does his 10 years, he gets the cash. Yes, 10% is put into shares, but it's the preponderance and the reliance on large cash short-term bonuses which is at the core of the criticism, and I think you really do need to actually come out and specifically explain why you have to have a highest in the world model of short-term cash bonuses different from your Wall Street competitors who do pay massive amounts of money but not so concentrated on short-term cash.
Can I correct a couple of facts? Firstly, there is no possible way which less than 30% is the difference between some of the Wall Street systems is that they do withhold and put into shares higher than 30%, but generally the vesting period is much shorter than ours. Ours is 10 years. Often the Wall Street firms are 2, 3, 4 years. So after 2, 3, 4 years, they've got the lot in cash, whereas the 30% that we require to be withheld up front is withheld for, and only gets to vest at the end of 10 years. The other point is that the 20% that is withheld is at risk not only as to income, but also as to capital gain, because they are linked to the funds that generally where the people work, or for the more senior levels, a blend of funds. So that if the Macquarie Airports, for example, went down and Macquarie Infrastructure Group went up, then someone had an element of both, they would be not only tracking the income of those funds, but also tracking the capital appreciation or depreciation of those funds. So it's not cash, it's not at risk. It's fully at risk, including obviously that the shares are at risk, and so is the other 20%. And it's locked up, more importantly, for 10 years, which is, I think, a much more effective long-term sort of incentive, a much better alignment of long-term interest than a bigger amount in shares, which is free of any handcuffs in a short period of time.